Good morning. Welcome to the press briefing of the UN Information Service. This morning is Friday, 20th of July. We have quite a few announcements I think, last minute. And the first one I start with is Pascal's, who has an update on the Council. Pascal.
Thank you, Alessandra. Good morning, everyone. We have a quick but important update to this program of work of the Human Rights Council. The United Nations Human Rights Council will hear from the Minister of Foreign Affairs of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Mr. Abbas Araghchi, today at 3 p.m. Geneva time. Mr. Araghchi will intervene in person in room 20 at the beginning of the Council's afternoon meeting. And after his intervention, the Council will resume its normal program of work. And just a reminder that the meeting will be webcast live and that our colleagues from UNTV will film the intervention. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Pascal. And I would like to also add to the program of this afternoon a press conference, a press takeout that we just announced by His Excellency Daniel Meron, Ambassador and Permanent Representative of Israel to the UN Office at Geneva, who will speak at the takeout of the Council at 2:30 on this subject, press statement on Iran. So now you have the update for this afternoon, and if there is any further question, we are available, of course. Otherwise, can I see if there are any questions? There aren't? Okay. So let me see if James is connected. I see he is. James, thank you very much, Pascal. James, thank you very much for being with us. You have conducted an incredible mission in Gaza, very, very close to the children there. And you are connecting quickly between two planes from Amman to tell us what you've seen and what you have reported about. You've got the floor. Thanks for being with us.
Alessandra, thanks so much, and nice to see everyone, and good morning. This briefing will really focus on water, and then I can speak to anything else relevant to the journalists. In a war already defined by its brutality, Gaza now teeters at its deadliest edge. Currently, just 40% of drinking water production facilities remain functional in Gaza. Now, without fuel, each one of these will stop operating within weeks. So, since all electricity to Gaza was cut after the horrific attacks of 7th of October 2023, fuel became essential to produce, to treat, to distribute water to more than 2 million Palestinians. If the current more than 100-day blockade of fuel coming into Gaza does not end, children will begin to die of thirst. Diseases are already advancing and chaos is tightening its grip. Now, whilst alarm bells rightly ring on the nutrition situation in Gaza, just yesterday, UNICEF reported a 50% increase in children admitted for treatment for malnutrition from April to May. That's 6 months to 5 years. Water can't be sidelined. And so in the most relatable terms, Gaza's facing what would amount to a man-made drought. Water systems are collapsing. Now, however, because this is man-made, it can be stopped. None of these problems are logistical or technical. They are political. Denial has become policy. If there is the political will, then the water crisis is eased overnight. Fuel means that water flows from hundreds of groundwater wells and restores supply quite literally within a day. But time is running out. To help further paint that picture, without fuel, desalination plants that already operate on reduced capacity, they will cease to run completely. Now, critical membranes, the things that help those function, they'll close, doing immense damage to that machinery. So right now, without fuel, trucking millions of litres of water to people will stop. It will cease to happen. On the streets in Gaza, the thing you notice more than anything else, everyone carrying anything they can to try and retrieve water. At major production points now, you see large numbers of donkeys queuing and they're replacing trucks. Now, this is the last gasp of a collapsing system. A donkey can barely carry 500 litres. You see it heave under the weight of 500 litres. A truck takes 15,000 litres. And even the donkeys are slowing. There's barely enough food to keep them surviving. So that's water. which is unprecedented now. We have hit uncharted terrain again in Gaza. Fuel is, of course, also holding Gaza's devastated healthcare system together. Without fuel, hospital generators stop, oxygen production stop, life support machines stop, ambulances can't move, incubators go dark. Denying fuel doesn't just cut off supply, it cuts off survival. Sanitation, the sewage systems are broken, sewage now flows into makeshift shelters and tents. There are already suspected cases of Hep A and of Hep E, both of which are highly infectious. On nutrition, as mentioned, just as the water crisis is man-made, so too is the malnutrition it fuels. In Gaza, these two crises feed off each other, creating a deadly cycle. Now, on average, since the start of this year, every day, each and every day, more than 110 children have been admitted for treatment of malnutrition. Again, 6 months to 5 years. Colleagues, at the start of my two-week mission into Gaza, a friend said to me, quote, "We've learned to live without so much. We've learned to live without loved ones. We've learned to live without our homes, but we cannot live without food." A few days when I saw him again before I left, he clarified that statement saying, "We've learned to live with so much, without our homes, without our loved ones. We've even learned that we can live without food for a week, maybe two, but we cannot survive without water." UNICEF is very clear. This is Gaza's most critical moment since the war on children began. A woeful bar to sink below. A virtual blockade is in place. Humanitarian aid is being sidelined. The daily killing of girls and boys in Gaza does not register. And now a deliberate fuel crisis is severing Palestinians' most essential element for survival, water. Thank you.
Thank you very much, James. This is really an appalling description. I'll open the floor to questions now in the room or online. Let me see if there's any hand. Olivia, you are online. Olivia Le Potvin.
Hi there, James. Thank you very much for this briefing this morning. I just wanted to check, you were saying, 40 drinking water production facilities remain functional in Gaza? And also just secondly, just talking to the point about the broader hunger issue, what have you observed on the ground in terms of these reports of people being shot at, injured and killed while trying to receive food aid on the ground? Any observations in terms of types of injuries that people have endured or any sense of scale in recent days and weeks? Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Olivia. So it's 40% of drinking water. Drinking water is key here. This is the first time we've been able to disaggregate between household water, which is often brackish, saltish, and drinking water. So it's 40% of drinking water production facilities, and that 40%, I'll share the exact number in the briefing note that I'll send immediately after this. So they're big and small desalinations operated by the authorities, supported by humanitarians and NGOs, and that's all no cost. Within a couple of weeks, they're gone. That is crisis on top of crisis. It is hard to articulate how things get so much worse in Gaza. Now, important, Olivia, and it gets very confusing in a way, Water, this does not include the three Mekrot lines. They are three lines coming from Israel. They supply drinking water. The supply there is determined by Israel, okay? Two of them need repair, and the northern line is fine and could take a lot more drinking water simply with political will. The repairs are the same. It's not about logistics. That's not complicated. The repairs are also about political will. We are way below emergency standards in terms of drinking water for people in Gaza. To your second question of GHF, yes, it is making a desperate situation worse. You have to go back one step. As colleagues will know well, humanitarian aid is about needs-based. You go to where the need is and you make sure you reach those people in need. You assess the need and you go to where they are. And we have got scores of examples, of course, Olivia, over 50 years since World War II. We don't need to go back that far. We can go back 2 months ago. 2 months ago, during the ceasefire, hostages go home, 500, 600 trucks a day, 400 distribution points, 400. UNICEF was going door to door in cases for malnutrition. What did those 400 distribution points mean across the UN and all the brave partners on the ground? Malnutrition falling, disease falling, access to water, medicines increasing. These sites have less than a handful. So you have 500,000 people facing starvation with a lethal choice of being forced into very small pockets where most people can't access into what are officially known as combat sites. I have met children, we know of children killed at these sites. I met a little boy who was wounded by a tank shell at one of these sites. On the final day of me leaving Gaza, I learned that this little boy had since died of those injuries. That speaks to both what is happening at these sites and what is not happening when it comes to medical evacuations. So the lack of equity, Olivia, is so, so critical. All our messaging around, what does a single mum do? What does a grandmother do? When I go on the ground, I speak to a grandmother in tears, saying, how am I possibly to get to these sites? It's the same people all the time that get them. It's the same people. It's the people with knives. I've met young men who've been seven times and never returned with anything. So there's a complete lack of equity. There's a complete lack of sites. You cannot distribute aid in a militarized zone, in a combat zone by one party to the conflict. And of course, humanitarian aid is so much more than food in a box. It's oxygen kits, it's ventilators, it's hygiene packs, it's medicines, it's incubators. It's all those things that the United Nations was doing just a couple of months ago. The final point I would make, Olivia, is that one of the reasons you've seen, one of the reasons, these mass casualty events seemingly increasing, is there's such the level of desperation, all those other reasons I explained, but also there's such little public clarity on when they're open. And again, they are combat sites officially deemed. So there's confusion among the population around opening hours, but it's a desperate population. There have been instances where information is shared that a site is open, but then it's communicated on social media that they're closed, but that information was shared when Gaza's internet was down and people had no access to it. And still they go, and then they're deemed as entering a combat site. That is what I saw. And yes, I had many, many testimonials of women and everyday people who went there and were injured, or those, as we know, children who died of their wounds at or around these sites.
Thank you very much, James. John.
Good morning, James. Thanks for the update. I was wondering if you have new information to share on the number of therapeutic centers operating in Gaza for children with severe acute malnutrition, and what have you documented in these facilities? How many children have died of SAM in the last few weeks that you can confirm to us? Thank you.
John, I'll get back to you with a number that we have across the course of this year. These numbers are very, very difficult, of course, because as you know, as an expert, John, that most children with severe acute malnutrition die of an everyday illness that makes a child 10 times more likely to die. At the same time, accessing that data is incredibly difficult. I spend a lot of time at Nasser Hospital. It is the only now fully functioning hospital in the south. So it serves a million people, John, but it's entirely in a red zone. People with trauma wounds, ambulances will come. Civilians with children with severe acute malnutrition will not come. In fact, civilians with children who are on oxygen have left because of the fear that NASA may come under attack again. And as the doctors told me, if you have a child who needs oxygen and they leave without the oxygen, they will, over a matter of time, die in a tent. So I paint that picture, John, just to say I'll get you the best numbers we have. And there was a press release yesterday, but in the situation, and certainly in terms of the relentless siege, if you will, on hospitals, it's very difficult to ascertain any number. And if we do, it will be a gross undercount.
Thank you very much. And I remind you that there was a UN team who visited the Nasser Medical Complex in Khan Yunis 2 days ago. So there is more, I think, from WHO if you want to ask them. John.
Sorry, it's a follow-up, James. In what you mentioned, having difficulty to access the hospital, what is the situation for parents where the child is suffering from severe acute malnutrition, will require therapeutic feeding, otherwise it will die? So are we seeing many of these children that you're having difficulty document dying because unable to reach these therapeutic facilities?
I don't have the numbers to speak to if it's many, John. There is no doubt that children are dying from a whole range of underlying issues beyond the bombardments and trauma. And that as much as those on this briefing have heard warnings many, many times before, those warnings in terms of the nexus between malnutrition and water and disease, they hold of 18 months ago. The point is now we have hit a new low given the restrictions, 100 restrictions. So I don't have that. I can't give it because you go into camps and there is no way if a child died there of any particular illness that would necessarily be recorded at the moment. Again, 700,000 people have been displaced since the ceasefire ended. So the ability, as soon as you understand who is in a camp and then they are moving again to another entire part of Gaza, which does speak back to water again. For children whose responsibility it often is to try spend a day finding water, invariably they've moved again. They're in a city that's not their own. That's very difficult when you've got an entirely stressed population and an eight-year-old girl is one of 200 people behind a truck. So again, to reiterate that one clear number, fuel, which is synonymous with the distribution, treatment and production of water, has been blocked for more than 100 days going into Gaza. This could be fixed with a stroke of a pen, and the levels of stress in Gaza right now, because of course aid has been reduced to less than 10%, the virtual blockade, the daily mass casualty events, nutritional crisis we spoke of yesterday, all the health crisis, WHO said, and now water is at its shortest, least amount since the 7th of October.
Terrible. Before I give you the floor, Beza, sorry, Christian has a little bit more on the health situation.
Yeah, thanks so much, James, for leading on this here today. This is so important. And let me just remind everybody that malnutrition is such a complex thing because children, weak people, elderly, they die not of malnutrition per se. They die normally of the diseases which then hit a weak body. I mean, I think the latest report says 610 patients have been admitted due to severe malnutrition complications. But what does that mean? That means these are the lucky ones who made it so far to get to a place. This does not count the many who were too weak to reach any point, who are too weak, who cannot be transported because the roads are blocked, because there are no ambulances, because the hospitals, some of the health emergency centers have been shelled and bombed and are being constantly shelled and bombed. So this is the scenario we're talking about. So malnutrition is just a small blueprint indicator here of the starving population. And the result is a dying population.
Absolutely. Beza, sorry.
Good morning. First of all, I want to ask the WHO about, you said that those are the lucky ones, the 610 that reached. I want to ask, do you have any estimate on what would be the total number about the malnutrition complicities in Gaza? And I have a second question for James. As James said, it's hard for desperate people to follow the opening and closure hours of these aid zones, resulting them entering combat zones and dying. I want to ask if James thinks closing hours are being announced openly and widely enough to make sure these incidents doesn't happen. Thank you.
Yeah, let me start. I mean, this is really a bad guess to make how many people are really suffering. You saw the IPCC report, which is now a couple of weeks old already, with the level of famine-like conditions and with the amount of people being at the situation of starving. And again, because people are somewhere in the houses and somewhere in shelters or somewhere out in the open and cannot be reached and they cannot go to a health center, any estimation is so difficult. It's similar with deaths, by the way. Let's not forget, deaths are being counted in official places. That means hospitals. So any death outside is a guess or can only be counted once found by an ambulance or reported back to a hospital. This is the, I'd say, problem with official figures, but we know, and maybe James has more, that this is a rough underestimate. The 610 are not an estimation. These are actually figures reaching the hospitals. But James is in the field, and I would assume he has seen more.
Definitely, James.
Yeah, to answer the second question on the clarity, I think it is certainly one part of it, but it's a much bigger part, which is... I was asked a question about, isn't it better than nothing? It's a false equivalent. We're not comparing to nothing. We're comparing to humanitarian aid systems that have worked since World War II. We're comparing to what we saw in Gaza 2 months ago. So we don't need, the idea of sidelining an extensive humanitarian system will only exacerbate the situation, as I say again, because a handful of sites. Again, because if you're a single mother, if you're elderly, if you're wounded, if you're amputated, you cannot possibly reach them. And again, if you're a mid-30s strong man, I've spoken to people who've been there 7 times and not succeeded. These are combat sites. This is everything the United Nations warned about before it was set up. And now, beyond our worst imagine, is a scenario taking place. Remembering humanitarian aid, when we say principled and neutral, they're not nice words. That's how it works, and that's why we have the trust of communities. So when you see these horrendous mass casualty events around the sites of desperate civilians seeking to get food, remember, at some point in the Gaza Strip, WHO is doing service delivery. UNICEF is doing nutrition with malnourished mums. Clean water is being distributed. And at no point are civilians being killed in that. At no point. So the problem lies with sidelining a system that is tried and tested for 70 years.
Thank you very much. You have a follow-up?
I just want to have a little bit of clear answer if you really find it enough of an announcement of about opening and closure hours or not. Opening and closure hours of the 8 site zones.
There have been mass casualty events around those sites when they have been closed. There has been contradictory statements made, contradictory statements to a population entering a combat zone can be lethal.
Absolutely. Agnes, I know you have a question, but I haven't understood if it's for James or for... Go ahead.
Another question was if the stakeout would be on UNTV as well.
Oh, you mean the stakeout on the Israeli ambassador? That's the one I announced before. Any other question to James or Christian on Gaza before we go to the next topic? I don't see any other hand up. James, thank you so much for connecting from Amman. Have a safe trip back, and we'll wait for you in Geneva. And thanks so much for having told us about what you saw and in such a comprehensive way. Thank you. Christian, you're on again, and together with Dr. Calypso Chalkidou, I hope I pronounced well, who's the director for health, financing, and economics at the WHO. I don't know if we would like to start.
Yeah, let me just say, I think, I mean, it's difficult times in terms of what's happening geopolitically, but since the health financing impacts many, many, many countries around the world, not only WHO as an organization or funding cuts, not only the UN as such, but it's the beneficiaries who are suffering. That's why I thought it's high time to bring a bit of a briefing and an overview of what the situation looks like and what the challenges and possible options are. Thank you, Calypso.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Well, I think it's fair to say that the world is faced with a health financing emergency. The decision by the US government to freeze or discontinue aid programs, coupled with several public announcements by European governments to drastically reduce aid, has created significant disruptions in the aid ecosystem and to national health systems. Health aid is projected, by our own assessments, to decline by 35 to 40% in 2025 compared to the 2023 baseline. This is less than 10 billion or so from a 25.2 billion in 2023. This is in real dollars. 11 OECD DAC countries members have announced in Q1 this year reductions in aid-related budgets for 2025. This matters because in several sub-Saharan African countries, external aid plays a most significant role in the financing of health systems. In the latest WHO Pulse survey, countries are reporting back peak COVID-level service disruptions, so disruptions not experienced since the peak of COVID. In most of these countries, the U.S. Development Assistance for Health was the main source of external aid. U.S. Development Assistance for Health represented up to 30% of current health expenditure in countries like Malawi, 25% Mozambique or Zimbabwe. This is a shock that's not happening in a vacuum. It comes after decades of underinvestment in health by national governments in countries, especially in low and lower middle-income countries. And this has made donor funding a critical component of health financing in these countries and has perpetuated effectively aid dependency. Since 2006, per capita external aid in low-income countries has consistently surpassed domestic public spending on health. And to give you a sense of how much poor countries spend on health through public budgets per year, the per person per year amount is around $8, $8 US per person per year on health through public financing. Only a handful of countries in sub-Saharan Africa have met the commitment they've made to allocate 15% of their national budget to health. And what makes this situation even more difficult is that in addition to these systems being dependent on external aid, the second most important source of financing is out-of-pocket spending. So this is money that households, poor households, have to source and spend, giving up on other needs, including food and schooling, in order to access health services. And this is the most inequitable and least efficient way of financing a healthcare system. Now, at the same time, it's very difficult to suggest that governments in these countries actually pick up and fill the financing gap. In many cases, this is not desirable either. We know that aid itself suffers from inefficiencies. We know also that the burden of servicing their debt is huge right now. We're looking at about twice as much on average as a proportion of GDP being spent by sub-Saharan African countries in servicing their debt as compared to health. So twice as much spent on servicing the debt than spending on health. So that is quite significant. And at the same time, because of all sorts of issues, including illicit financial flows, Africa is now on a continental level the most important, the biggest net creditor to the world. Africa is actually exporting capital to other parts of the world, public and private players. And that is quite problematic given the situation we're faced with. Now, in terms of solutions and what we're trying to do, working with countries, receiving requests, supporting ministries of health, ministers of finance, understand, first of all, where the gaps are. Because of the way aid has been channeled all these years, a lot of the time it's not just about the financing gap, it's about a visibility gap. So governments find it very difficult, national treasuries find it very difficult to understand how the money has been channeled through systems, a lot of the time parallel systems, and what exactly the money was going to towards. So this is important, trying to understand where the gaps are. And then another important gap is that of capabilities. So running supply chains, procurement systems, IT systems, a lot of the time for procuring medicines, these systems have been run from the US or other centers. And so it's very difficult for countries to step in and fill that gap. Our advice is also very much towards protecting the poorest, because we know, we have anecdotal evidence that what is happening currently is households are footing the bill, and more households, effectively people going into poverty because they have to contribute out of pocket to make up for the lost revenue from aid. We're making a case for mobilizing new revenue, including through better taxation and taxing the things such as tobacco, alcohol, and sugary drinks. We know this is a public health intervention that works and can generate some revenue. But also generating efficiencies, so working again with countries to look at pooled procurement approaches at regional or continental level, making sure helping ministries of health fully execute the budgets that are allocated to them, reducing overheads, and better integration also of vertical programs into government-run programs. These are difficult things to happen in a very short period of time, given how abrupt these cuts have been. We're also working with multilateral development banks to look at how we can enhance highly concessional lending towards the most cost-effective treatments, going towards those people that are mostly in need. And we're hoping that this bigger financial agenda will be aired and discussed, and some actions taken post the Financing for Development conference coming up in Seville. We think this is absolutely critical. Universal healthcare coverage matters, and ultimately, as our DG says, UHC is a political choice. Thank you.
Indeed. Thank you very much, Doctor. Let me see if there are questions for you in the room. Don't see any hand up. John Zarokostas on the platform. John?
Good morning. Thank you very much. Can you please clarify the 10 billion that you mentioned in the beginning of your briefing? Is that your estimate of all the multilateral and bilateral aid going into health globally? Is that your figure? And roughly, do you have the breakdown of that 30% that you estimated was from the US? How much of that breakdown was from the US aid, and how much was from the financial line from the State Department aid segment? Because there's two, there used to be two.
Thank you. So yes, this is 10 billion less we're estimating. These are projections for this calendar year. And these are estimates that refer to reduction in aid for health. They're made up to a large extent by US cuts, but I don't have the exact breakdown now. I can get that for you. But I can't differentiate right now between the different parts of the US subset within that figure. So this is projections based on both bilateral and multilateral aid reductions based on the announcements by OECD DAC countries, including the US, and making some assumptions also about how much of this money is likely, especially for the US, is likely to be unfrozen. Though following the latest rescission decisions, I think we're edging towards the upper end of that figure, 35% to 40%. And also to say that we're expecting some estimates to be published next week by our colleagues at OECD, which will not include, I don't think, multilaterals, but I think there are important estimates coming from OECD on DAC members, including the US.
John, you have a follow-up?
So I think I haven't had my coffee and got a bit confused. What I'm interested is what the 10 billion is a reduction for this year. What is the, do you have an estimate, what would be the total figure spent bilaterally, multilaterally for health, say what it was in 2024, and 10 billion reduction this year, so we can have a comparison.
Sorry, maybe I haven't had my coffee either. So compared to, what is the comparator, the 10 billion for this year, this calendar year, compared to?
John?
Yeah, the total figure spent multilaterally and bilaterally for health through aid channels, and the amount for this estimated for this year, so we can have the differential figures.
So the total amount we're estimating in real dollars in 2023, which was the base year, right? We're looking at 2025 compared to 2023, was a bit over $25 billion US. And we're estimating a $10 billion or so reduction off of that figure, which brings the figure, the total, down lower than the lowest point in the past decade or so. I can offer more detailed numbers on that and point you to a link as well where we've done the analysis.
Thank you very much. Do you want to add something?
Yeah, Jim, maybe just to say that because of all these figures, we did already send the briefing notes to you all. I hope they're well received, so to make a bit more and easier sense through all these figures. Thank you.
Yeah. Indeed, it has been sent. So it's, any other question to WHO? I don't see any other hand up. Doctor, thank you very much for this important update. Christian, thanks also for your answers on Gaza. Let me ask Olga to come to the podium. Thanks again. You want to keep?
No, no, I'm just...
Welcome, Olga, and on a special day for the international community and specifically for UNHCR, the refugee agency. Today, as you know, is the World Refugee Day. We have shared with you the statement of the Secretary General on this important day, where he honors the millions of refugees displaced by war, persecution, and disasters. As you know, the Secretary General used to be the High Commissioner for Refugees. This is a subject which is really close to his heart. In his statement, he highlights the suffering of the refugees, the growing global xenophobia, and the unfair burden placed on developing host countries. Despite limited support, refugees continue to show resilience and contribute positively to society, say, as G. Guterres. He urges the international community to move beyond words and act through increased aid, protection, asylum rights, refugee participation, and long-term integration efforts. He concludes with a call to choose solidarity, courage, and humanity in our common response. And I'm sure Olga has much more from High Commissioner Grandi and from UNHCR.
Thank you, Alessandra. We also shared the statement of the High Commissioner Grandi yesterday afternoon, so you have that also on your emails. So today is World Refugee Day, a moment when we honor the courage and strength of millions of people around the globe who have been forced to flee their homes due to persecution, war, and violence. It is also a moment to advocate for the right to seek safety and to make a strong call for a world where refugees are welcome, protected, and valued. This year, we mark World Refugee Day with a heavy heart, as civilians remain under attack in many parts of the world. Brutal, futile, and prolonged conflicts are causing unimaginable suffering and inflicting deep scars that will be difficult to heal. The recent escalation between Israel and Iran is the latest sign of alarm. We think of all civilians impacted, Iranians and Israelis, they must be spared. We must avoid further regional instability and displacement. Last week, we released our annual statistics update, the Global Trends Report. It showed there were 122.1 million people forcibly displaced by the end of April 2025, decade high numbers. That's one in every 67 people worldwide forced to flee from their homes to save their lives, equivalent to the population of Japan. One third originated from just four countries, Sudan, Afghanistan, Syria, and Ukraine. And while the needs are growing, brutal funding cuts are dismantling the support systems refugees rely on, with UNHCR and partners forced to make difficult decisions, including scaling back operations in several locations. We are doing everything possible to prioritize the most impactful activities and protect the most vulnerable, but critical programs have already been affected. We are also seeing attacks on asylum and growth in the humanizing narratives around refugees, which are fueling fear and concern.
yet we cannot give up. As the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, Filippo Grandi, said recently at Georgetown University, even in the darkest of times, there is hope. Please never lose sight of that hope. Today, Mr. Grandi is in Syria to mark World Refugee Day. After more than a decade displaced, 2 million Syrians have now returned home. Their journeys are only made possible by the solidarity and sustained support provided over the years by neighboring countries, communities, and generous donors. In moments like this, when fear and division seem louder than compassion, these positive developments and our collective voices matter more than ever. The recently published Ipsos survey on public attitudes towards refugees confirms there is still a groundswell of support to the right to seek safety. Two-thirds of the public in 29 countries support the principle of offering refuge to those in need. And a considerable proportion continues to acknowledge the positive contributions refugees make to their new homes. The survey also reveals that a vast majority believe that wealthier countries should do more to support refugees. On this World Refugee Day, we call on governments, organizations, the private sector, and the public to come together in solidarity to build solutions for those forced to flee so they can rebuild in dignity and return home when feasible. Increased financial support is critical to support both refugees and the countries that host them. While this year's commemorations might be more restrained, events around the world are taking place in solidarity with refugees. Art exhibitions are happening in Bangladesh, Qatar, Georgia, community events in Amman, Athens, and Paris, sport events in South Africa, monuments lit in blue across Colombia, Brazil, Canada, and also here in Geneva. And we are launching a refugee employment guide in France, developed in partnership with the Ten Foundation. These are just some of the events that are happening through the week. Then, just to finalize, we want to thank you here in the room, but also online, for your continued support to bring in refugee issues to the spotlight. This is not a time to turn our backs. It is a time to stand firm in our commitment to refugees and displaced people everywhere.
And maybe we can show this.
Well, yeah. Actually, this year we've made an activation with our Goodwill ambassadors and celebrities. So these are bracelets that are done by refugees across the world. So we are selling those to support the refugees that are making those. And also this year include a small donation to UNHCR so we can continue doing our work around the world.
And we are going to wear it, I think, all of us, to show our support to the refugee cause and to UNHCR. Thank you very much, Olga. Any question to Olga on World Refugee Day or other subjects? Don't see any hand up in the room or online. So thank you very much, Olga. And yes, we will celebrate with our bracelets. Thanks. Kathy. While I put my bracelets, Katina is coming up for an announcement for UNCTAD.
Oui, bonjour à tous, non? Oui, ça y est, ça marche. Bonjour à tous. Je voulais vous rappeler, enfin, vous inviter à un background briefing jeudi prochain sur l'intelligence artificielle et l'économie numérique. Nous avons plusieurs axes de travail. La secrétaire générale, lors de la conférence de presse sur le rapport sur l'investissement dans le monde, a rappelé que l'ECOSOC a donné à la CNUSED un mandat qui s'inscrit dans le pacte pour le futur pour travailler notamment sur la gouvernance des données, mais aussi sur l'investissement et sur le commerce en développant en particulier les capacités productives dans les pays en développement pour les amener à mieux participer à l'économie numérique. Donc pour aborder les grandes réunions qui vont avoir lieu en juillet, du 7 au 11, il s'agit de WISIS plus 20 et de AI for Good Global Summit auquel nous participons. que nous co-organisons, eh bien, je voulais vous proposer donc un background briefing avec nos experts. Il s'agit des personnes qui s'occupent de l'intelligence artificielle. Vous vous rappelez qu'on a annulé la conférence de presse du rapport sur la technologie et l'innovation qui traitait spécifiquement de l'intelligence artificielle. Vous l'avez pour le développement, bien sûr. Vous avez bien sûr eu tous les documents, mais donc on va revenir sur ce qui sortait de cette recherche pour nourrir les débats qui vont avoir lieu lors de ces grandes réunions de juillet. Donc il s'agit de Angel González-Sanz. Vous allez recevoir une invitation avec tous les détails, qui s'occupe donc de la technologie, de l'innovation et de la connaissance à la CNUSED. Torbjörn Fredriksson, qui dirige l'équipe qui s'occupe du commerce électronique et de l'économie numérique, et d'un économiste spécialisé en intelligence artificielle, Antonio Vezzani. Voilà, donc il s'agit d'un background briefing. Il n'y aura pas de document en particulier. C'est pour échanger avec vous, répondre à vos questions, et j'imagine qu'il y en a beaucoup sur ce sujet. Voilà, ça sera jeudi 26 juin à 10h dans cette salle parce qu'elle est fraîche. Merci.
J'espère que ce n'est pas la seule raison.
Non,
d'accord. Des questions pour la CNUSED ? En ligne, non. Et dans la salle non plus. Alors, merci beaucoup, Catherine. I have a few announcements for you, which is what I'm left with. Somebody has asked, I think Agnes has asked, so just to repeat, the stakeout of the ambassador and permanent representative of Israel at 2:30 today, it's not here. It's in the stakeout position behind room 20, and it's not webcast. So you will have to come to listen to him in person. Also, somebody has asked me to confirm the Security Council meeting entitled Threats to International Peace and Security. It's going to be at 10 a.m., I think, New York time. It's confirmed. I was looking to try and find if there was a webcast. I think it will be, but just check on the live schedule of the UN Web TV. So these are the two things. Then I have a few announcements of other press conferences. First of all, at 1 p.m. on Monday, 23rd of June, the UN Special Rapporteur on the Right of Everyone to the Enjoyment of the Highest Attainable Standard of Physical and Mental Health of the Human Rights Council is going to present the thematic, is going to brief you on the thematic report to the Council focused on health and care workers as defenders of the right to health. So this is Dr. Tlaleng Mofokeng, and there will also be a recorded video message by Dr. Tedros, Director General of WHO. So that will be here in this room. At 3 o'clock in this room, in person, please, an off-the-record briefing by Undersecretary General Guy Ryder to the Geneva Press. This is off the record, and it's about the UN80 initiative of the Secretary General. Let me explain, because we have had a few questions from you when we have announced this. So Mr. Ryder, USG Ryder, is not in Geneva. He will connect from New York, but for technical reasons, we have to ask you to be in this room. The connection can only be made from this room. So please be in this room. And USG Ryder will brief you and answer your question from New York. So please, here in this room at 3 p.m. for an off-the-record briefing. On Tuesday, 24th of June at 2:30, another conference on human rights, a press conference on human rights. This is Human Rights and International Solidarity. It's given by Cecilia Beye, the UN independent expert on human rights and international solidarity. The title is Call for Solidarity and Peace, Addressing the Normalization of Violence and Arctic Militarization Risks Through Indigenous Peoples' Examples, including insights from the independent experts' visit to Denmark and Greenland. Also on Tuesday, at 9 a.m. New York time. That will be in New York. The Secretary General will set out a compelling and evidence-backed case for why the renewables revolution is now inevitable and the benefits that a just transition away from fossil fuels will bring to economies, energy security, and people's well-being. So this is a special address from the Secretary General. Its title is A Moment of Opportunity, Supercharging the New Energy Era. It's a follow-up to his Moment of Truth speech of last year and will be accompanied by the release of a special technical report prepared by the Secretary General's Climate Action Team with the support of UN agencies, funds and programs, as well as leading international institutions, synthesizing the latest available science and evidence on the progress, opportunities and benefits of the emerging clean energy economy. That speech will be live streamed into the State of Climate Politics Forum event, which is organized by an independent climate think tank at the London Climate Action Week. It will be, of course, live streamed by UN Web TV, so that's 9 o'clock New York time on Tuesday, so that, if I'm not wrong, it's 2 o'clock here in Geneva. And of course, you will be able to follow this on UN Web TV. We will send you the speech as soon as we get it. I think this is for the press conference, the events. Just a couple of words about the committees of human rights. Today, the Committee on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women is reviewing, in fact, the report of Ireland. On Monday, the committee will meet with civil society organizations from the countries whose reports are to be reviewed next week, which are Afghanistan, San Marino, Chad, and Botswana. Also on Monday, the Human Rights Committee will open its 144th session at 10 a.m. at Palais Wilson. During this session, the committee will review reports submitted by 7 state parties to the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, which are Kazakhstan, Guinea-Bissau, North Macedonia, Latvia, Spain, Haiti, and Vietnam. We will be able to announce you also the meeting, next meeting of the Conference on Disarmament at a later stage. And if I'm not wrong, I think I've told you everything I had. So I don't know if there is any question before we close. No? Okay. So thank you very much. If there are no other questions, I wish you a very good weekend, and I'll see you next week. Thank you.